Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Around the world, in every country, you will find people who speak English. It is the number one, number two language. It's estimated there are about four times as many people who speak English as their second language than there are people who speak English as their first language. Around the world, there's about 1.5, 1.6 billion people who speak English, and only about 360 million of them speak it as their native tongue. So this begs the question, why is English the international language of choice?
This comes from the British Empire, where it was kind of introduced. So if we think about a context like India, English is introduced there as this colonial language that then is associated with education, associated with kind of the scientific and industrial advancement of the time. And so it's this kind of second language that you learn for that aspect of life.
Another factor is the ease with which English adapts.
English has always been very ready to borrow. Some people describe it as a promiscuous language because of this.
That willingness to pop in words from other languages is one of English's appealing characteristics, but it's really just a small slice of the story. When you consider just 500 years ago, only 4 million people spoke English. So to understand what happened and why English took off, you have to turn back the clock to the worldwide network of countries that existed within the British Empire to start to understand why English grew so quickly.
We also have England associated with the Industrial Revolution and all the cool technology that's coming because of that. And one thing that that did in terms of science was that it drew people from all over the world, continental Europe in particular, to England to be part of that kind of sphere, to be creating really exciting kinds of things. And so that then meant that all of these technological advancements were being discussed and talked about in the English language. Mm-hmm. So this is where English really starts to get its kind of scientific and technological boost associated with creativity and opportunity associated with that.
Fast forward 200 years.
The sun was setting on the British Empire. The United States was becoming economically more powerful and having that kind of influence. So it was just kind of a trading of hands of English-speaking countries that really kind of allowed this maintenance of English as a global language to come about.
Now, add in the collapse of distance with the introduction of air travel.
The aviation bit really comes through at the end of World War II, where we have kind of the Allied forces coming together to kind of starting to decide on some kind of shared rules and regulations for aviation. Two of the big powers in the Allied forces spoke English. Most of the major manufacturers of aircrafts were being done. Those were located in the U.S. And so it's kind of, again, just most of the people who are involved in this are speaking English. So that's what makes English the language that's chosen for these kinds of things. One thing that's really important to remember in all of this is that there's nothing special about English that makes it good at these kinds of things other than it seems to be the language that everyone is using for it. It seems to be the language
right.
That's in the right place at the moment of these technological advances, at the moment of these economic opportunities. There's nothing inherent in the structure of language that makes it better at these kinds of things.
Well, now you add in IT.
Yeah.
The explosion of IT in the last 25 years
has
gone global.
Mm-hmm.
And where does all that development happen? In the United States.
Exactly, yeah. So if you think about kind of the long history of the internet, it's something that's kind of the precursors are developed in the 1960s in the US, where it's a way to network academic institutions, government institutions, all of these kind of groups talking together using English predominantly because they're in the United States. In the 1980s, when this gets kind of released to the world, kind of sharing with other groups, I don't know the specific history of this, but I can imagine that the first people that the U.S. invited into this relationship were countries like Canada, countries like England,
mm-hmm.
that where now we have this kind of connection of English. And so right from the beginning, most of the internet was in English, and that's kind of maintained a foothold as the language of online interaction.
There you have it. English is big. But the challenge is understanding one another. There are multiple versions of English. There's Chinglish, Hinglish, Franglish, and on and on and on. It might be enough to get you by when you're purchasing a sandwich at a deli, But
moving into a country like Canada, there is certainly the need to some extent to kind of learn how to communicate in a new cultural context.
But it's not easy, and failing to master the accent of the place you call home can have negative consequences. What do you say when you're trying to tell the emergency room nurse or doctor why you're in pain, why you're calling the police for help, or you're asking for directions? And then there are career-limiting implications. My next guest, Indeshni Pillay, helps people master the 44 phonemes and the graphemes of English, and she maintains it can be done, and the benefits are countless. Indeshni Pillay, welcome.
Thank you.
This seems like an odd thing to be bringing up in some ways, because I'm, you know, a white guy talking about, and English speaking, talking about why it's important to not have an accent that gets in the way of intelligibility. Well, maybe that's not even the right word. The ability of the listener to understand. Mm-hmm. And so I want to start off by asking you, is it a bit of a racist thing to say you should get rid of your accent?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I think there are two sides to this answer. So one of them is that, you know, we want to make sure that we're empowering people to make change. And we also want to make sure that discrimination against any sorts of things, including accents, that we're fighting that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are accents that get in the way of other people understanding what someone's saying. There's accents that make people feel their self-confidence is affected, their self-esteem is affected. And I think at that point, we need to provide guidance and help. We're not talking about changing your accent because we don't like accents. We're talking about changing accents that cause communication difficulties,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, someone, life and their goals, they can't reach them. You know, this conversation's not a black and white conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we have to do is we have to recognize that accents can actually, you know, cause difficulties. And then we have to give people choice. You know, do they want to change it? Do they want to fix it? What can they do about that? And I think those two things go together.
Okay, so as you're answering my question there, I'm thinking, okay, well then what is the right accent? Because even though you and I understand each other mm-hmm. perfectly with the accent that we're using to speak English, what happens if we go to another part of the world and there's a different accent? Is it incumbent upon us to learn that mm-hmm. accent? Or, you know, is this accent that we have the one? Because I've heard that, you know, Canadian broadcasters do very well because everybody can
yeah.
understand them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no right accent. There is no wrong accent. I think it's not that one accent is the one to have or not. I think where it comes down to is if that accent can't be understood in whatever forum you're in, you need to make modifications.
Okay, but how do you do that? You know, you learn to speak your native tongue and you grow up, it's immersed in you, it gets wired into your brain in a certain location. And we know that as you learn a second language, your brain develops that in another region of the brain.
Yeah.
So how do I all of a sudden go, oh, okay, so that's how I create that sound and it's appropriate within this language or this environment?
You know, I think we do it all the time. So all of us who communicate, we do something that's called code switching. And what that is, it's called code switching. And what it is that basically you're going to tinker with how you communicate depending on the situation or the person that you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, I'm speaking to you in a different way today than I might with going out for a glass of wine with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
There's just changes I make in my communication style that I do regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, so that's a typical situation. So all of us have that ability. Where it gets difficult is if you're born in a different country,
mm-hmm.
you don't have that ability to code switch like you and I have, and then you move to a new country. I think some people need extra help.
So how do you go about doing that? And, you know, is it really worth that effort? Like,
Yeah.
Step one, how do we do that?
It's, you know, it is a pretty simplistic but complicated process. And what I mean by simplistic is this is very systematic. Mm-hmm. So speech pathologists, the reason that we're involved in accent reduction is that we study communication, everything from how our breath supports speech to how our tongue moves and how we create sounds. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing that we do with someone who comes from a different country is we look at what are their individual sound patterns. Mm-hmm. So we actually analyze every sound they make.
Did they make?
That they make.
So what's that sound called? There's a word for it. Is it
a phoneme?
A phoneme, right. Yeah. And as I understand in English, there's 44 of them, is that right?
There's more. It depends on what, how you analyze sound. Some people take it down to like the minute level, but there's some broad, 40 is probably a good representation.
But are those phonemes different in different languages? And is that where part of the challenge arises, that I'm not used to creating that sound?
Right. So when the majority of people that we see, we're teaching them a standard, if there is such a thing, North American accent. Mm-hmm. So if their p sound is slightly off or wrong, we're changing that sound so it fits into a more a spectrum that's easy to understand.
How do you do that? You said it's simple but complex because you're talking about minute variations in formations in the mouth and what you do with your breath and so on. Yeah. How do you get somebody to be able to start to emulate that?
It requires that analysis. Where we're looking at everything. And then what we really focus on is really practical functional stuff. So we're not going to change something if it's not affecting intelligibility. But if it is affecting intelligibility, we're going to change it. And mm-hmm. the way that we change it is by practicing it at a really, really simple level and then making it more and more complex. So, for example, if we're trying to change that p sound, we would start with simple words like pal and pay. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is teaching people how to make the sound with their lips.
Yeah.
and then we go and make it more complicated. So
you have to do it consciously first.
You do.
But you really have to be conscious of what you're doing.
As this is a lot of it is motor skill. And with any motor skill, you need to practice.
And the more you do it?
And the
right.
Got it. But I think where people struggle is they need that expertise initially to sort of give them that idea of, okay, this is what we see as the barriers. These are the sounds or the things that you have to change, and this is how you're going to do it. And we start people off. But really, how much progress they make is going to depend on how much they practice.
So there is accent, but then there's also pronunciation of a word. So I may be able to clean up my accent, but still not understand how to pronounce that word.
Right.
And knowing where in the word I put the particular emphasis.
Right.
Because this, of course, affects the way that it's heard.
Yeah. So you're right. Accents are, it's not just about the speech sound for sure. It's about stress. It's about intonation. It's about voice. It's about rate of speech. We saw someone recently from Newfoundland, and the only thing that we did to help him was get him to slow down. It had really nothing to do with the sounds that he was making. It had nothing to do with actually teaching him p or anything like that. It was slow down.
Is that because in Newfoundland or Newfoundland, which I can never quite figure out how to pronounce, they tend to speak faster?
Yeah, their rate of speech is faster.
Hmm.
And there is variability around rate of speech, but again, it comes back to code switching. So in a situation like this, I might speak a little bit slower, but when I'm out with friends, I might speak faster. So there is variability, but if your variability is on that high side, like you're speaking too quickly, and now you're in a different place where people are struggling to understand you, if it's that speech rate that's making it difficult, we need to change that.
So when it comes to this, let's just take a look at some of the ways in which accent can get in the way.
Right.
We talked a little bit about health, but where else does it become incumbent upon us to be able to speak in the vernacular of the environment in which we live?
Yeah. You know, we tend to see a lot of people who it's affecting their jobs, or it's affecting their ability to get into university.
So how's it affecting their job? You know, I hire you to do a job. I want you to do that job. I need you to be able to think your way through it. But how does an accent get in the way of them being able to, well, maybe let's say advance their career or communicate what it is that they need to do?
So a good example is I was working with an IT specialist. They were hired for a lot of, and I'm going to use all the wrong words because it's not my field of study.
Just make sure you pronounce them correctly.
yes, I'll pronounce them correctly.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were doing mostly, I think, coding and a lot of technical work when they first started. But what happened was this person was brilliant. They were really good at what they did. And the next move up was I was a project manager. So instead of doing the actual technical work, you led a team in doing that. And this person could not get that job because of communication difficulties related to an accent.
So they're that brilliant, but the accent gets in the way.
Absolutely.
So then how do you help? Like, where do they go if they don't know about you and your partner helping people to deal with this? Where do you go to get those kinds of resources?
You know, this particular person went to their HR person. They had a really good open relationship about advancement. And it's a really difficult thing for some people to talk about accents in an open way as any other type of professional.
It's almost like saying I have a disability.
Exactly. But this particular HR advisor was, you know, open and was sensitive enough to have a really good conversation with the employee and said, you know, we'd love to put you in that role. We think that, you know, you're going to have to work on your communication skills a bit. And the employee was like, great, I want to do it. And I had worked with the company before, and then the HR advisor contacted me, and away we went.
So how long did it take somebody who clearly this is a problem? Like, if you're talking and you can't be understood, no matter how smart you are, and I get that, somebody's brilliant, still they can't do it on their own. They need your assistance. How long before they see this change starting to enter into their speech pattern?
You know, it's a range. So much of it depends on your ability to listen and mimic. Some of it depends on how much you practice. And a lot of it depends on how much the accent is affecting the ease of which someone's understood. So, for example, the guy from Newfoundland, that took 2 sessions.
That's it?
Yep.
Well, that's not much.
It was because, you know, we were changing one thing, and he had the ability to do it. He just had to make it really conscious in his mind to really slow down. Other people, it takes a lot longer. Where, you know, we're seeing them for 6, 8, 12 sessions. And there's a lot of work that they're doing in the background.
So, I you know, I started off by saying, you know, is it racist to say that you ought to change your accent? But if you don't, does cultural bias start to enter in to the way that somebody responds to you? And this is something that I worry about, because if it does, you may be seeing a restriction of access to opportunities and so on, and you may perceive it as being, they don't like me because of the color of my skin or my culture and whatnot, and yet it maybe just comes down to, I'm having trouble understanding you, and I don't know how to tell you that I can't understand you without feeling as though I'm being offensive.
And I think, you know, when we started the conversation off, we talked about, you know, we've been talking about accents and accent reduction and when it makes sense. But it doesn't mean that we have to, we have got to fight the bias that exists, for sure. So, you know, there was a recent study that showed that people with heavy accents were thought of, their message was thought of as less true.
Less true. Just because of the accent.
The messages were exactly the same, but if you had a heavy accent it was paired with, it was considered to be less true. So we have to fight.
Wow, that's an uphill battle that you're fighting.
We have to change stereotypes and perceptions and accent bias. We absolutely have to do that. But I think there are times when, if someone can't be understood, we have to, you know, we have to do something about it. And we have to be, we have to have a conversation about it, because there's an elephant in the room. If you're not promoting that person because of their accent, if you're kind of like, what did they say? And you think, oh, I'm mm-hmm. going to avoid that person because I can't understand what they're saying. That doesn't do our society any favor either.
Well, we lose out on the potential of that individual.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. I think those people, they know it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a conversation that we have to have, but in a respectful way, in a positive way. And I think it comes down to a balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's your intent in bringing it up?
What's your intent?
So can anybody change their accent? Because I'm sure that there are people who go, yeah, okay, I've tried, but I can't do it. So
yeah,
it's not possible. It's only a select few that can.
No, everybody can change their accent if they practice.
Wow.
If they put the work into it, I can guarantee you they can change it.
So what's the number one most important thing that you want somebody to take away from this conversation?
I think it's about communication and the importance of that. Communication is so far-reaching in our lives, and it's such a huge, huge thing. And when someone has an accent that's hard to understand, it's affecting their self-confidence, their self-esteem, I think that they should have choice around whether they choose to do something about that. There is systematic, proven scientific help for that, and I think they should be given choice.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in and doing this.
Yeah.